Yeah. Okay, good evening. Good evening. Welcome to the LSE for this LSE public event. My name is Professor Jeffrey Schweroth. I'm head of the Department of International Relations and Professor of International Political Economy at the London School of Economics and Political Science. I am very pleased to welcome our speaker, Dean Arantxa Gonzalez, and our audience here to the Sheikh Zayed Theater tonight. Arantxa Gonzalez is the third dean of the PSIA at Sciences Po and the first woman to lead the world's third school for politics and international studies. Prior to joining PSIA, Dean Gonzalez served as Spain's Minister of Foreign Affairs, European Union and Cooperation from 2020 to 2021. She was previously Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations and Executive Director of the International Trade Center. Between 2005 and 2013, she served as the Chief of Staff to the Director General of the World Trade Organization, Pascal Ami. Before that, she held senior positions at the European Commission in the areas of international trade and development. Dean Gonzalez started her career as a lawyer in the private sector. A Spanish national, Dean Gonzalez holds a degree in law from the University of Navarra and a postgraduate degree in European law from the University of Carlos III of Madrid. With the current international order under severe stress from climate change, major technological advances, and more assertive authoritarian regimes, Dean Gonzalez will seek to answer two key questions. What are the forces shaping the new international order, and how can it be shaped for people, the planet, and shared prosperity? For Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE New Order. This event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, there will be a chance at the end for you to put your questions to Dean Gonzalez. I will let you know when you have the opportunity to do so by opening the floor for questions. At that time, you can raise your hand, and then when I indicate, a roving mic will reach you in the audience and you will then pose your question. At the time, please provide your name and affiliation and try to keep your questions brief. And now I ask you to join me in welcoming Dean Gonzalez for this evening.
Thank you very much for this very kind words. It's a bit daunting for me because normally in the Paris School of International Affairs, I would be doing what Jeff just did, which is basically introduce the guest, the speaker, and pass the hot potato on to the speaker, and then relax until question time comes. And now find myself in the hot seat. And on a topic that it's not easy to address, but which I will try to do this as an observer, trying not to take sides, trying to describe what I see, but also maybe trying to give you some ideas of what the international order could work on if we were to try to improve a little bit the manner in which it works. Just yesterday, we marked the 77th anniversary of the UN Charter. And I always like to start with the UN Charter. It's, in a way, the foundation of the international order in which we live. It started there. And it started after two world wars that led the international community, led by the four big powers at the time, the US, the UK, China, and the Soviet Union. These were the four big powers who built the system. And what they thought the world needed, and the rest of the international community followed, especially those that had lost the Second World War, is that we needed to create a system that would help us prevent a third major clash at the global level. A third world war. The four architects of the system we have today, because we haven't fundamentally changed it. The US, the UK, China, and the Soviet Union. They built the system. And they started the UN Charter with the part that I like most, the preamble, which says, and I'm going to quote, "We, the peoples of the United Nations, determine to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind." This is how they started to build this order. And this preamble continues, "To reaffirm the faith in fundamental human rights," human rights, meaning the rights of all humans, just as if there was any question about what human rights are. Sometimes there are questions about whose rights are we talking about. Is human rights, the rights of all human, "the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small." They built these principles. And they also said, "The purpose of the UN are to maintain international peace and security. All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat of use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state." They took these commitments. I wanted to start here because sometimes there are doubts about who built the system and what this system was about. This is how it started. These are who built the system, and these are the commitments that they took when building the system. I think today it bears repeating. This is what we call the international order. Now, this international order, plus minus, has helped us in navigating the 77 years. And I also want to recognize, in saying this, that it is an imperfect international order, that there are many things in this international order that didn't work out as we had originally envisaged. We stress-tested this international order in a big way during the Cold War. And some of the protagonists of this big four were in a big conflict, and they took the conflict to a point that they stress-tested the resilience of this system they built. Obviously, the system was sidelined when decisions were taken, such as the invasion of Iraq, whose digestion is still with us. The stomach is very persistent with the digestion of Iraq. We also saw, in 2008, the largest meltdown in the financial system since the Great Depression, prior to building the system. What we said would not happen again, well, it did happen in 2008. We've also seen insufficient slowdown in CO2 emissions, insufficient protection for workers' rights, insufficient protection of biodiversity. There have been wars. There's been violations, and there are violations of human rights around the world, and much more. So the system is an imperfect system. We also have to acknowledge that. But imperfect as the international system is, it has given us one of the longest period of collective prosperity. It has helped lift more than 1.3 billion people out of abject poverty. Now, we repeat these phrases And I'm not sure that we really understand what we are saying. But it's not a small thing that 1.3 billion people live better today than they left. They lived 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 60 years ago. And it's also thanks to the resilience of this imperfect system. There's been expansion of middle classes. There has been progress, inequality, and the recognition of the rights of minorities, and equality between men and women. And there's been a huge wave of decolonization that brought many new countries into the United Nations. All of this is also the positives that we have to put into the international order. I thought I would start with 77 years back, because sometimes we make the shortcuts and we forget where we are coming from. And I think it's important that we start from a shared assumption of where we are coming from before we decide where we want to go. So, yes, this is the imperfect system of global cooperation that has helped us in progressing, in having mankind progress. Now, this now has turned this imperfect, unstable balance we were living in, it's turning into a dangerous imbalance. It's an imbalance that risks fracturing the world again. It's an imbalance that risks fracturing the world economy. It's an imbalance that risks fracturing the international order. And it's an imbalance that risks fracturing the system, the imperfect system of international cooperation that we have. Now, two major things are happening that are at the epicenter of this move from a precarious balance to a very dangerous imbalance. First, there is obviously Russia's invasion of Ukraine. An invasion that has brought back the feeling of the old colonial wars, the old empires, what we thought that was not any longer possible in the 21st century, that belonged to the 20th century. Sometimes when I travel abroad and I meet many of my counterparts in other parts of the world, they tell me, well, you know, why do you make such a fuss about war in Ukraine? There are many other wars around the world. And I have to explain that there are many other wars around the world. But this is a war that is particularly terrible for Europeans that decided to vaccinate themselves against colonial wars, against imperial wars. And that what we are today, especially for those of us who are members of the European Union, this is like the nightmare getting back to us again. So it is a major change when a member of the Security Council, without any reason or excuse, decides to invade another country, violating its territorial integrity and its sovereignty. And I don't think there is any excuse or any reason for this invasion. There are many mechanisms that Russia had at its disposal if it wanted, if it had a problem, if it had a grievance. There were many avenues that could be explored to address these grievances. There is the Council of Europe, there is the OECD, there is even consultative committees within NATO where one could, can, should discuss grievances that one has. It chose not to. So I don't think there is any excuse for this aggression. But the result of this aggression has been a weaponization of energy. It has led to an increase in the prices of food, of fuel, of fertilizers that are having a knock-on effect all around the world, not just in the vicinity, all around the world, and with particular damaging impact on many countries for whom food, fuel, and fertilizer are a very important part of domestic and national spend. As a result, many countries that were already fragile, barely coming out of the COVID crisis, find themselves now in another round of debt traps. And we've got now a long list of countries that, bar a reform of the international financial architecture, will simply default. This is the result of the war in Ukraine. But there is also a growing Sino-American rivalry centered around technology and very much in a power competition. We've seen this with two events that have happened in the last days, the issuance of a national security strategy on the US side, with a very clear description of the competition that now sees in China, and with the adoption of a set of measures to limit the ability of China to benefit from technology or labor related to technology that is American. We have also seen the mirror image of that in the Congress of the Communist Party in Beijing, with an affirmation, exactly a symmetric affirmation of the rivalry with the US centered on technology and in what is now a major geopolitical power competition. This is the world we live in. So we live now in a new phase of this international order, or should we say disorder, that is characterized by a structural insecurity, that is characterized by the bifurcation of developing countries, something that is particularly worrying, and with the breakdown or the potential for a major breakdown in multilateral cooperation. In my view, if this is the scenario we are facing, I think we have to avoid three miscalculations. Miscalculation number one, that the existing order, which some consider to be broken, is replaced by no order or by an even worse order. Now, of course, better or worse will depend on who looks at it. But there is the possibility that it's worse for every participant in this international order. So miscalculation number one is, let's be very careful about throwing out of the window the existing order, because we may end up with no international order, or with one that we would like even less. Miscalculation number one, but there is miscalculation number two, that the breakdown of the order leads to turmoil that prevents both democracies and autocracies from delivering on their social contract. Obviously, breaking the order will not come without costs. And what happens when the costs are such that neither the democracies nor the autocracies can deliver for their citizens according to their social contract? We risk to see in democracies an even wider polarization, more extremism, the rise of the extremes. This is clearly the case in the case of democracies. But in the case of autocracies, and I'm thinking about China, it's not going to be easy also for the Communist Party in China and the contract it has with the Chinese citizens. Miscalculation number three, that the rest of the world would be very eager to take sides. If what's happening in Ukraine is a thermometer, if it is a thermometer, then we can see that there are plenty of countries that are not in the mood for going back to some sort of Cold War where they've got to choose their friends and they have to therefore leave others as foes. Now, I would also be very cautious, looking now more at the economic front, about slow walking into a geo-economic fragmentation, which under the guise of friendshoring, tech decoupling, national security, or disconnection of payment systems would simply lead to higher inflation, lower economic opportunities, in particular for developing countries, less innovation, and less productivity. The risk is not one of deglobalization. We read a lot about deglobalization. Last time I checked, the figures are not showing a deglobalization. The risk is one of fragmenting. So yes, globalization will continue, exchanges will continue. The intensity of these exchanges, which today is not so much driven by trading goods, but rather by technology and trading services, and in particular, intermediate services that have become tradable all around the world and represent the new frontier for international trade, that this be subject to different rules, different conditions in different parts of the world. That we fragment the playing field that we have been painfully building in the last 77 years. Now, the IMF and the WTO are clearly warning us against the risk of fragmentation. And they are trying to put figures that would give us a sense of the risk, that the size of the risk that we are facing. The IMF tells us that technology fragmentation alone can lead to losses of up to 5% of GDP. The World Trade Organization, who has run a few numbers also, more related to international trade, tells us that dividing the world into two trade blocks could lead to a fall in global GDP of ballpark figure 5%. These are obviously estimates, and probably they are underestimating the reality. They are focusing on a narrow set of potential outcomes from the fragmentation, but let's be very careful with the fragmentation of the level playing field that would lead to higher inflation, lower growth, lower opportunities, and I'm thinking about the opportunities that have helped reduce extreme poverty for these 1.3 billion people in the last decades. Now, it doesn't look any better when we look at climate change or when we look at nuclear non-proliferation, because here we are in the area of existential risks. This is not about a bit more GDP or a bit less GDP. These are the two existential risks that humanity is facing, and which cannot be addressed without a modicum of international cooperation. Now, when I say that this cannot be solved without a modicum of international cooperation, I don't want you to feel that I am naive or that I am underestimating the difficulties of international cooperation. I want you to believe that I'm a pure realist that is laying for you what will happen if we don't do it. Because the world is also turning in the other direction. Those who say that there are risks are called naive. Those who say that the only avenue to address some of this risk is through international cooperation are not realist enough. Well, I consider myself to be pretty realist, but I know that if there is not a modicum of cooperation, we cannot limit the use of nuclear weapons. I also know that there is no way we will accelerate the reduction of emissions and help the most vulnerable countries build their resilience if there is no modicum of international cooperation. So how do we do that? Because it's good to lay out all the risks without talking about what can be done. So here's a few things that, in my view, can be done and should be done. Let's start by what can be done at home. Because let's face it, the international order is fragile also because countries are not doing their job at home. So let's start with what the members of this international community, the international order, could do at home. I think they have to be a little bit better in making the economies work for all. There has been a lot of laziness in the international community with putting the blame on others, or putting the blame on openness, putting the blame on trade, putting the blame on the neighbors for things that simply have not been fixed at home. I have spent over 25 years of my life in international trade. So I know that two countries with the same trade policy have fared very differently in terms of growth, in terms of unemployment, in terms of productivity. Two countries with the same trade policy. So where is the answer? The answer is in what countries have not necessarily done at the domestic level to ensure the costs and the benefits of more trade were better distributed. So the first task for countries is to make sure that the economies work for all. And for those of us who live in democracies and believe in democracy and want democracies to work, we have to make sure that we heal the divisions that plague our democracies. Because divisions, extremism, will only breed weaker democracies. So that's the task for members of the international community, and they have to do this at home. And if they do this at home, they will be stronger players at the international level. Let's look at what we could do internationally to reset international cooperation. I'm going to propose a few principles of what I have seen work to foster a bit more international cooperation. First, we probably have to be a bit more issue-focused. The idea of grand design, big multilateralism, is very difficult today. So maybe we have to go for more focused, issue-based multilateralism or international cooperation. We have seen in July how the World Trade Organization took one issue, reducing subsidies to overfishing, and they got all members of the World Trade Organization to agree to it. They got China, they got Russia, they got Ukraine, they've got the US, the European Union, and the rest of the 140 plus members of the World Trade Organization to do this. So maybe we have to go for more focused, issue-based multilateralism, like the international community has done recently at the OECD with a deal on taxation of multinationals. So focus in order to focus attention and political energy. We need an international cooperation that is based around sovereign states, but also reaches beyond sovereigns to include other actors that have become essential to international governance, businesses, NGOs, scientists, foundations, trade unions. We need to reach out beyond sovereignties. The real change in this decades, the 77 years also, that they are now stakeholders and actors in the international scene that are not sovereigns and can help us with building this new international order. I would also propose that we move from the more diplomatic culture to a culture of results and impact. We spend a lot of time around diplomatic procedures and display of diplomatic culture, but maybe we have to focus our international work more on results and impact, measuring, building more on the accountability side. In my view, we have to also pay more attention to preventive multilateralism, the one that would help us identify the problems before the problems have erupted and treat those problems before they have escalated into a global challenge. And with preventive diplomacy, I think we have to pay more attention to building resilience. Now, building resilience is not disengaging from the rest of the world. Building resilience is now including in the risk framework, not just the old risks, but also a new risk called geopolitical risk. Finally, I think we have to continue to pay a specific attention to those that are smallest, weakest, and poorest. They should not be the side casualty of the big power competition that we see appearing in the horizon. So, this is a recipe for a few things that we could use to reset the multilateral order. Nothing prevents groups of countries, alliances of countries, to build on this floor more ambition. This is what we have been seeing in the 77 years. But let's remember that the alliances would be much stronger if they have a floor that is common to everyone. And this is the part we should not neglect. So let me, in order to give enough time for your contributions and for your considerations, let me end by saying that the word that in my view is missing in the conversation today is trust. And that multilateralism and international cooperation and resetting the international order will require trust. And as we know, fear leads to fear. Trust leads to trust. So we've got to start finding the spaces for trust building that will help us expand. The choice right now is between a fearful, very disorderly world, or maybe a more trustworthy, even if imperfect, international order. That's the task that we have ahead of us. I hope I have convinced you that it is worth studying international relations. This is no boring time to be an expert in international relations. And that being an international relations today means investing in building, not in deconstructing, in building, building the system that we want for the future. Thank you very much, and obviously the floor now to you.
Great, thank you very much for your presentation, Arantxa. We will now open the floor to questions from the audience. And if you could raise your hand, we'll select some questions in rounds. Please try to keep your questions short, and we will aim to answer as many as possible. And please do remember to state your name and your affiliation. So questions, please. One on the left.
Thank you. My name is Ming, and I'm a first-year international relations student here at the LSE, and I just have a question. My question is that you talked about moving from a culture of diplomacy to one of impact and results. So by that, are you advocating for more international intervention in domestic affairs? And if so, how would you balance international intervention with respect for state sovereignty?
Yeah, I mean, moving from a culture of diplomacy to one of results and impact is not about intervention in sovereign states' affairs, although that would give us that would take us on a different path. But it's more moving the international order from the rituals of diplomacy into something that is more looking at results and impact. So the rituals are basically the gatherings, the speeches, the debates. The results and impact is measuring what is it that we have achieved. How many more people are safer today? How much more water do people have? What's the quality of the food? Where are the weapons that can kill us? How many biohazard products are now under control? That's a culture of results and impact. So I think we need, and it's difficult because obviously the rituals are very important to international relations. You know this very well. How you receive a dignitary, where does the dignitary sit, where you start the banquet, who toasts, whom you sit at your right, whom you sit at your left. All this is the culture, the rituals of diplomacy. And this is very important in international relations. But we also have to pay a little bit more attention to what is it for? What do we do with it? So I've taken you a little bit away from the question of intervention into domestic issues. But more to discuss a little bit more, why do we want to make this international order work?
Hello, thank you very much for your remarks. My name is Erica George. I'm a professor of law, international law. I'm visiting from University of Utah and here for the semester. I was struck by your mention of non-state actors. In international law, they don't have legal personality. Facebook is in France. It can't sign a treaty, yet it can have a significant impact. It has more members, subscribers than most countries have citizens. So I wanted to invite you to speak to what the role of those actors might be. Trust was something you mentioned, and arguably there isn't a lot of trust in some quarters for some corporate actors. Are there positive, constructive examples of the way that businesses is exerting its influence internationally? Could you share those, and what do you think the parameters could be?
So you write that non-state actors are the more legally invisible part of the international scene. But if you look at some of these non-state actors, they are extremely powerful. Their decisions matter for the governance of our commons. Let me give you an example. When the sovereign, the US president, decides to pull out of the climate agreement, the mayors and the businesses in the US build coalitions to step up emissions reduction. Now, granted, the commitments that businesses are making don't figure in the debate as such or in the legal commitment that the US takes in the UNFCCC. And yet, whatever businesses will do in the commitment to reduce emissions will have an immense importance to the ability of the US to meet its target. So, you have a very clear example of how non-sovereign businesses in an alliance can take a commitment that can have an impact on one state meeting its commitment. Now, what if we were to articulate a little bit better this space? What if the UNFCCC would have a special segment incorporating businesses and their commitments, and a special accountability mechanism? Take another example, product safety, food safety. Businesses, or take another example if you wish, artificial intelligence, where we don't even have where we don't even have legal frameworks, and where the sovereigns are incapable of working right now. They have a bit of, for now, they've agreed to kind of signed a declaration of how they intend artificial intelligence to work. Well, you've got a lot of non-governmental organizations. They're helping build pledges from actors to abide by certain norms. Those norms are private norms. They are not public norms because they've not been produced by the state. They are produced by private actors, but they are changing the manner in which artificial intelligence is governed. So I think we need to look at the actors in international governance with a broader lens. They are no longer only sovereigns, but it's true that from a legal point of view, the action of all these non-sovereigns is much more fluid. It's much more, the accountability mechanisms are much more complicated. So this is the space where maybe at the time when sovereigns find it very difficult to agree and to advance governance, they can step in. Paris is just happens, it's not just that Paris is where we sit, but in Paris there is a gathering every year called the Paris Peace Forum, which is a very innovative experiment that puts together sovereign businesses, foundations, NGOs, around issues. Around issues. So they don't look at what will the state do, but they look at how can we fix this problem, and who is interested in contributing to fixing this problem. Now, it's an experiment in a different kind of governance that for now has limited frameworks, limited established legal frameworks. It's more informal, it's more private in setting, but it may be an avenue to explore when what we need to do is build trust. Let me give you another sector. Science. Scientists, if you look at what science is doing today, what scientists are doing on synthetic biology with the advances in genomics, is phenomenal. Now, where are the boundaries to science? This is being discussed nowhere. But maybe it's a conversation that scientists can have, that can help build trust. All I'm saying is that we need to look beyond the manner in which we did governance in the last century, in the 20th century, very state-centric, very intergovernmental, and it needs to now focus on actors that go beyond simply the state to try and first reflect the real world of today, where these actors are as powerful as sovereigns, but without an accountability framework that sovereigns have.
Okay, now there's a lot of questions. Great. There was one in the back, and then there's one on the right, and two on the left.
Thank you very much, Dean Gonzalez, for this very enlightening talk. So my name is Andrew Pico. I'm doing a Master in Public Administration here at LSE, as well as at Columbia. My question sort of harps back to the previous question asked by my colleague. And obviously you talk about impact. My question is about how do we measure it? I think especially amongst all the international sort of disharmony we're having at the moment, my question sort of is orientated towards where do we find the common guidelines to have sort of a metric which is respected and obviously can be a value of such to ultimately measure the impact that you talk and how important it is for this new international order. Thank you.
So my experience in, I've now been in the three states of the matter, if you wish. I've been in the solid, which is in a national government. I've been in the liquid, which is the European Union. And I've been in the gaseous, which is the United Nations. I've lived in the three states of matter. And my experience has been that we have incredibly strong accountability mechanisms with clearly delineated matrix to use, but we don't use it. And we don't use it because, obviously, I don't use it against you, and you don't use it against me, right? I scratch your back, you scratch my back. Now, it's not that the mechanisms don't exist. In the IMF, we've got Article 5, you've got the possibility to look at the financial solidity of a country. In WTO, you've got trade policy reviews that look into, it's a health check on state of affairs of a country's trade policies. And I could continue. The OECD has plenty of mechanisms with plenty of matrix. This is a space that is underutilized. And with a bit of, intelligent discretion and intelligent maneuvering, this should get more attention than it has until now. In every organization, the shiny part is to negotiate new treaties or new rules. The one that always is the hidden part is the accountability. And yet, the accountability could give us today much better results, given that the legislature, the norm-making, is in many instances paralyzed. So use these spaces. You don't need to, and this is where it's tricky. You don't need to use it as a weapon against others. You have to be careful in how you use it. But you have spaces to use it. Let me share with you a secret. During the 2008 financial crisis, one of the big risks that the international community faced was that countries would close their markets to try and solve their national issues with the obvious spillover effect on the others. So they would export their problems, right? Through protectionist measures. So I was in the WTO at the time, and we realized that we needed a mechanism to measure that risk to ensure we would foster good behavior on the side of the international community. Now, there was no mechanism to measure protectionism. So we created a system in the World Trade Organization, but we didn't call it mechanism to measure protectionism. We call it a checklist on trade opening and trade closing measures. Why? Because it was not threatening. Had we said trade protectionism, half of the membership would have said no. Of course, we don't do it, it's the others that do it. And I'm not going to give you my data because otherwise you're going to finger point at me. So we said, okay, guys, give us the list of all the trade measures that you have taken that go in the direction of opening. Give us the list of trade measures that go in the direction of closing. If nobody gives us data, we'll take the ones that are used in the media. And then we'll give them to you for verification. So we started a process that tried to keep them on board, finger pointed at nobody, but fostered collectively good behavior. Now, we need more mechanisms of this type today, given that there is a lot of difficulties on the negotiating side, on the rules-making side. We have to use all these other spaces that we have in the rule book of every organization more smartly to foster first a conversation among the members and, if possible, good behavior.
More questions, please. This gentleman here.
Thanks a lot for your talk. Am I good? Is it my turn?
Yes.
Sorry. Please. Okay. All right. Great.
I'm showing the steward. Yeah.
Great. So I'm John Comey. I'm an economic history master's student here. So I appreciate what you said about diplomacy, how it needs to move towards actionable results away from just sort of procedure. I'm wondering, you know, I think that this year's Russia's invasion of Ukraine was one of the biggest failures of diplomacy that we've seen in decades, certainly since the Iraq War. And I'm wondering kind of, yeah, how you would see your sort of like more results-based model of diplomacy working there. And I also think back to what you said about sovereignty and when you and what you said about building an international order that creates a world that we would like to see. And when we have such a strong normative position, it obviously becomes difficult also to reconcile the forces that then come out of the woodwork in opposition to that. And so I'm wondering, how you would kind of recommend that we go about reconciling those two sort of diverging forces.
So first I would tell you that there is no antidote against craziness in the international order. Excuse me for saying this. So there is no guarantee in any international system, like there is no guarantee in any national system, that you are not going to have a decision taken by an actor that goes against not just the rules of the game, but against all logic. So I put the invasion of Ukraine into that category. There is, since in the 77 years, we've built incredible amounts, especially because this was also the front line of the Cold War. We built incredible amounts of mechanisms to basically try to ballast what was a very conflictual situation. There are mechanisms, as I said, there is the Council of Europe, there is the OSCE, there was a NATO space that was open for bilateral dialogue with Russia, where Russia could sit with NATO members to discuss issues related to, now, this has not been used. This is the reality. So I would put this into that category. There is no guarantee that even the best mechanism will cure against irrational behavior. Now, I think the difficulty we have is finding a way to coexist at a time when countries in this planet, especially countries that are systemic, have different national projects. Part are democracy, part are autocracy, and that comes the first fracture. Part are extremely nationalist, and see this through a national lens and a national lens only, and they see in engagement internationally as a minus, whereas others, maybe because of their history, because would like probably not to give away their sovereignty, but understand that pooling sovereignty makes them more secure and more safe. This is the logic in the European Union, if you want an example. But not every country sees it like this. Not every country wants to be a democracy. I find it terrible, because a democracy is essentially about giving the individual a set of rights and a freedom to decide and a space for its own decision that, to me, is fundamental in this world. But not every country sees it this way. So how do we coexist in this world where we see it in a different way, but we still have challenges that impact on all of us, and where the systemic countries are necessary to solve these systemic problems? That's the challenge. So we've tried different ways. We've tried to impose on the other a view. That's one way. You impose on the other the way you view the world. Or you try to find a modus vivendi, agreeing to disagree, because there are profound disagreements. And I'm not pretending that there are no profound disagreements, but we still are left with what happens when we've got the risk of a nuclear aggression. What do we do when the temperature in this planet is increasing beyond the worst case scenarios that we were running. What do we do when we've got a pandemic like we've just gone through that requires a modicum of cooperation? So I go back to, yes, we live in a world where the national projects of members of the international community are very different and in parts incompatible, but we have to find the space where we still, we talk, we agree, and we take decisions that will help us in managing those risks. Because the alternative, I'm not very convinced by what the alternative is.
One there. You got one way in the back. There's one. This student here. And there's a gentleman.
Thank you so much, Dean Gonzalez, for being with us here today. My name is Hafsa, and I'm an alumna of the Social Policy Department here at the LSE. There's been a lot of focus on the first kind of principle that you laid out in terms of impact-focused multilateralism. Let me take this opportunity to instead shed some light on the last one that you mentioned about protecting the most vulnerable, the weakest, members of the international community. So I'm from Pakistan, and we recently experienced some of the worst, flooding that we've seen in recent decades. To contextualize that, the impact of that for the people in this room, around 33 to 35 million people were displaced by that. That's four more times than the people who were displaced by the war in Ukraine. So it's a massive scale. This has amplified calls for redistribution when it comes to climate action on a global scale. So I'm curious to know, in terms of your perspective on this new international order, what is the place of redistribution? And on a more practical note, how can redistributive principles actually be operationalized when we think about this new international order, particularly in the case of global climate action? Thank you.
Thank you for your question, and let me tell you that you're putting the finger into what will be the essence of the discussion in the next COP that is taking place in Sharm el-Sheikh in a couple of weeks. Because this is also a central issue of fairness, which we haven't really delved into, but it's fairness in this international order. And in this discussion that will take place in Sharm el-Sheikh, there's going to be a collection of countries that will say, well, I didn't contribute to this, but I'm on the receiving end. In the case of Pakistan, it's 35 million displaced. In the case of Barbados, whose prime minister we had recently with us in Sian's Po, is the existence of the island. So there is a big discussion that needs answers concerning loss and damage, and also concerning the financing of the resilience that is needed, the resilience that some of these countries require in order to build their ability to continue to navigate despite the worsening of climate change. Now, this has triggered another debate, which is how do we use the international financial institutions to do that and to finance that? And it's a big conversation because we are not using the international financial institutions as much as we should and as targeted as we should to build this resilience, which speaks of the redistribution that you're talking about. And it's, again, a conversation that has been going on for a while, but which will crystallize in Sharm el-Sheikh, because a number of members of the international community will say, well, this is what's in it for me in here. And it's going to be very interesting, because these are the countries that, in a way, are in the middle of this big geopolitical fight. They have their list of issues that need to be resolved, And for this list of issues to be resolved, they need a bit of cooperation from the big guys. So it's going to be an interesting moment to watch. Now, on redistribution. There is one part of the redistribution that needs to happen at the national level. And this is why I started my to-do list with what needs to happen at home. Because this is also a debate that needs to happen within each one of the countries. And then there is another part of the redistribution that has to do with what happens with countries that do not have the means of the magnitude necessary to undertake this task, which is where the international community has to mobilize its support. Some of it through the international financial institutions, some of it bilaterally, some of it financial, some of it in the form of technology, which will help also, especially in the adaptation that will be necessary. But this is the next big agenda on climate change. And again, there are a lot of countries out there that will say, geopolitics for me is to make sure that I survive climate change. So what's the answer to me? And I think this will be a very important moment to bring this geopolitical fight down to where it matters, which is addressing the problems of the citizens on the ground.
There's one, and then that's two in the middle. There's a gentleman on the far right, and then there's a person in the middle there as well. Next, please. And then come back this way.
Hi, Dean Gonzalez. Thank you very much for taking the time to be here. My name is Matthew. I'm studying for a master's in international political economy here at the LSE. I'm also from Gibraltar, and we really appreciate your work.
Wow, that's the most challenging question. I can see that coming.
I'm not going to talk about sovereignty disputes because good. I think someone really asked you about it down there. I wanted to talk to you about in the context of Brexit, the rise of populism, and what should be the EU-level institutional responses, if any, speaking to what you spoke about the work that needs to start at home, to the danger that poses to the international order, particularly in Europe. Thank you.
Well, thank you for sparing me the question about sovereignty and Gibraltar, although you know that I think the word sovereignty has to mean something else than just simply erecting borders. Sovereignty has to have a meaning also. It has to be put to improving people's lives. And if sovereignty is about building a barrier, it's not going to help us. Which is why this discussion about sovereignty and what makes us more sovereign, and sometimes what makes us more sovereign is to be less sovereign. And it seems counterintuitive, but it's important to remember this also today. Back to your question. It's true that in our part of the world, let's say, because I don't like these denominations and I haven't really been able to find a better one, the West, the East, in our part of the world, let's say, we have a problem with a political polarization which is emptying the middle of the political spectrum, is pushing voters to the extremes. It's emptying the center. It's run on very often cultural choices. And it's forgetting about the fundamentals on what it means to live together, what it means to run an economy together, what it means to pay taxes, to run your public services. We are forgetting about this. Now, we are polarizing people, taking them to the extremes, and weakening our democracies, because with this you cannot, I mean, polarization essentially means you cannot address the fundamental problem that every society faces today. And the fundamental problem that our societies face today is that we are in the middle of two gigantic transformations of our economies and our societies, actually three. The technological transition, the climate transition, and the transition to a more egalitarian society where every member of that society has rights. These three require solutions that come from at the middle. And yet we are emptying this middle and pushing people to the extremes. So it's no wonder that the solutions that we propose very often don't fit with the necessities of the countries. And don't push me on that, because I'm in London and I want to be nice to my hosts. But when you make your decisions on the extremes, then you have to be ready to pay the consequences. And the consequences are now on display.
Thank you, Dean Gonzalez, for the lecture. My name is Agata. I'm from the International Social and Public Policy here at the LSE. My question to you is related to the regional organizations. How would you see the dynamics of the regional organizations despite of the rivalry between the US and China? For example, there are the Quad, the BRICS, but also the ASEAN, European Union, and other these organizations, and how the China also is getting more hostile in the South China Sea. How would you see that these dynamics from the regional organization contribute to the new international order? Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, regional organizations have traditionally been the players that build on the floor that the international, let's say, that the multilateral order provides, and they try to build, and they build upwards. ASEAN is a good example of how they've been trying to build more resilience within the members of the ASEAN community, sometimes very intelligently protecting the collective against attacks on the individuals. So I do think that regional organization, whether it's ASEAN, whether it's regional organizations in Africa, whether it's in Latin America, maybe because of my deformed European Union view, I value a lot these regional organizations to deepen the floor that the international system offers, and to deepen it with countries that maybe have closer affinity, they have more links, they are closer culturally or economically, and through that they can help create resilience. And this in Asia is particularly important because a big part of the geopolitical game in this world is in Asia. So I do think that there is merit in trying to, ASEAN is a good example, there are others, there is SAARC that also has a bit maybe less advanced, but also with the same ambition. They should be important actors in building resilience and ballasting the geopolitical forces at play.
There was one there.
Hello. Wait. Yeah, okay. Hello, thank you so much for your talk. So I'm Tony, I'm a third year IR and history student, and hopefully incoming master's student at the PSA, hopefully. So you might see my face.
Welcome to PSIA, Tony.
So my question would be about the UN. So you mentioned the UN Charter at the beginning of your talk about how it like, was a foundation of the post-war international order. So in past years, there was a lot of debate about the efficiency of the UN and how it might actually reach its objective of like, you know, maintaining international order and security around the world. And notably about the Security Council, about the veto power that sometimes is being used by Russia a lot, and that end of it action for being taken. So what do you think will be the role of the UN in future years in resetting the international order, as you mentioned in your talk? And what do you think the UN would need to reform to reach this goal? Thank you.
Well, first, the international order is the order that states built. It's an intergovernmental system. And it's an intergovernmental that obviously depends a lot on the health of the governments, on the health of the stakeholders, which are the nation states. This is still the very old paradigm, as we were saying a minute ago. There are many actors that are not there. The states are the owners of the UN, the states are the owners of the international system, and if they are healthy and they are feeling confident, the international system goes better. And if they are feeling uncomfortable, if they have lost trust, and if they engage in a power competition like now, the international system, including the UN, will suffer. Now, there is the UN and the UN. The UN is many things at the same time. The UN is certainly the Security Council, which is the magnet of a lot of eyes, pretty decredibilized in my view, with Security Council members, permanent members, that in my view are not respecting the principles of the charter. And this, in my view, when you're sitting in a very exclusive club and you break the rules of the club, it's a bit funny, right? So there is a conversation to be had about that, but obviously this is a conversation that has been going on for a while and has not led very far. Now, the UN is also many other things. The UN is the humanitarian organizations that are relentlessly providing assistance to those who most need it, whether they are refugees, displaced, those that are suffering from hunger, from malnutrition, from wars, from conflict. There is a UN humanitarian side that goes very unnoticed. You only know when they knock at your door to ask you for money, but they do an amazing work around the world. This is also the UN. So when we talk about the UN Security Council not working, let's think of the part of the UN that works. Then there is the part of the UN that is technical normative organizations, whether it's in the area of, and I see Tom there, whether it's in the area of intellectual property, whether it's in the area of telecommunications, whether it's in the area of food. These are organizations that are churning technical standards, technical norms. This is also the UN. And that kind of, in a clunky way, it works. The part of the UN that doesn't work is the part that is the political part of the UN, where the big decisions need to be taken. The big decisions concerning life or death. That part is, unsurprisingly, not functioning because there is, at the moment, a big collision. But there are many parts of the UN that are working, and we should also recognize that, because otherwise we throw, you know, we risk throwing away the baby with the bathwater, and through that damaging also, and leaving lots of people without a possibility and an answer around the world.
Yes, thank you. My name is Kevin. I'm from Master International Political Economy in LSE. My question is that when we speak about the new international order, we cannot get away from the new hegemon. We can see there's a debate of the rising power in China, and then a huge disparity between the global north and global south. So I want to narrow this to the issue of climate change. We can see the COP27 is coming. What should we demand from these rising powers, especially to represent the global south, to try to close the disparity between the global north and global south on the issue of climate change? We can see there's a call for repatriations, for instance, and on adaptations and the mitigations of climate change as well. Thank you.
We should ask the big guys to be responsible stakeholders. That's what they need to be, responsible stakeholders. It's not just big when it suits you. It's also big to assume the responsibilities of the big. And this essentially means reducing your emissions, which is in your hands at the end of the day, is deciding on your energy transition, deciding on the efficiency of your buildings, deciding on the type of vehicles and the rules that the vehicles of combustion would, the rules for their emissions. So the first ask from the big emitters, who happen to be the big players, is responsible stakeholders, reduce your emissions. Through that, you would already be doing yourself, but also the international community, a lot of good. Now, second, the biggest emitters have to be the biggest contributors, also in financial terms, to help those that don't have the means build the resilience, adapt to a world where we know will be hotter than we were expecting it to be. So this is what we need to ask them. They need to be responsible vis-a-vis the international community. And it doesn't matter if they are called US or they are called China or they are called EU. This is what they should do. Now, they should also cooperate in how we will treat exports of emissions, because this is the next battle. If there is no price for carbon internationally, the second best is to tackle this through controlling exports of emissions. This means border adjustment mechanisms. So we are going to go back to the conversation we just had on fragmentation. The preferred avenue would be, again, one carbon price. If this is not the possible avenue, at least a coordination of the border adjustment mechanisms. And this is also in the hands of these stakeholders who need to be responsible.
Thank you so much. My name is Julie, and I'm a third-year geography VCon student here at the LSE. I wanted to link back to one of my previous colleagues asked about the war in Ukraine. And I think you concluded by saying, you know, we can agree to disagree, but this agreeing to disagree is costing us energy, it's costing us food, and it's costing people lives. And I understand this might be a bit of a naive question, but is there anything you expect from international organizations at this point to happen with regards to the war that would end it sooner rather than later? I'm originally Polish, so maybe I have heightened interests in the war, or rather not in the war, but in the conflict ending, but I'd be very interested to hear what you can say about this. Thank you.
Thank you, and let me pay tribute to what Poland is doing, because it is not just hosting a huge refugee community, but it has also integrated this refugee community into the labor market, which is a bigger step. And I think this is how it should be. It isn't always like this. And it isn't always like this in Europe either. So I think it is when this happens, we have to recognize it. I think international organizations are doing everything they can to support, to alleviate. If I look at the grains agreement, that was a struck to get the grains out of Ukraine. It was brokered by Turkey and the United Nations. Sometimes we forget that there was also the United Nations. Now, there was a big chunk of United Nations in this, very silently, very discreetly, as it should be, got the agreement out, and it's alleviating food prices because it is making sure that there is offer on the market. Unfortunately, they couldn't do the same thing for fertilizers. They were close to doing it, they couldn't do it. As a result, that's a pain point. The UN is also on the humanitarian side, helping in neighboring countries, in Poland, in Moldova, in Romania, in helping the countries manage the influx of refugees, like they are doing in many other conflicts around the world where the same situation is happening. The UN is also now, together with a wider international community, planning a reconstruction, the efforts to reconstruct the economy of Ukraine, and there's just been a gathering in Berlin today, precisely with this in mind. There too, the international organizations are there. But this is about alleviating or planning the future. We still are stuck with the war in Ukraine. Now, unfortunately, this is not in the hands of the international organizations. And it is causing massive destruction, and it is causing massive human losses. But I would say this is outside the perimeter of the international organization.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks for the talk. My name is Ken Shadlin. I'm in the Department of International Development here. So you've talked about sort of the international responses to these big global challenges, security, climate change, big two, others. And it struck me, and I've enjoyed it, but it struck me as I was listening to you that like you didn't, we can't talk about everything, but you didn't talk about sort of global responses to another challenge, which is health. And I was sort of thinking, wow, for the last 3 years, nobody's talked about anything but health. And now we can all sit in and health can just not be talked about. And so I'm just wondering, like, what's your assessment of international cooperation in the last 3 years in the response to the pandemic and the suitability of the international order for responding to the next pandemics that we all know are around the corner in however many years? Thanks.
So you're right, maybe because we've been talking so much about the health part that I decided to skip it, but pandemic preparedness is another obvious candidate to a space where you need a modicum of cooperation. So let's look at what happened during the pandemic. There was a triple plus in cooperation among scientists. As soon as the pandemic hit, scientists got to work, started working together. And sometimes they didn't even have a sovereign to guide them or decide that they should do that, they just did it. Triple A. Governments, at the beginning, A minus. As time passed, they learned that it was not purely national, they had to do with a set of cooperative approaches. They did this at the regional level, not at the global level. They did this more on medical equipment, less so on vaccines. And then we are left with, so there the scene is mixed, and we are left with the World Health Organization that is limited in what it can do. And it's a pity because this is not the first major health crisis that the WHO has had to manage. The WHO has had to manage health crises like Ebola, H1N1, in avian influenza. All of these were moments when the World Health Organization had a chance to improve the manner in which it works. It's not the World Health Organization's fault. It's that the governments that are the stakeholders in the World Health Organization have not been open enough to give, to devolve more capacities to the World Health Organization for it to be the guardian when a pandemic hits and to be the organizer and the structure of the system when a pandemic hits. Now, there is a bit of, there's been as a result of the COVID numerous exercises of high-level reports that have now been put on the table. There is the attempt to build a pandemic treaty that will not be a treaty. This is what we know by now. Will be something different. But if it's not called a treaty, but it helps build more capacity in the WHO as an organization working with its members, next time a crisis hits, we would have learned something. But if we don't do that, then we would have wasted an incredible opportunity to improve the governance of the crisis response in the health area. I want to end, You see from my message that it's a mixed bag. I nevertheless think that one part that was quick to operate was the one concerning financing of vaccines. A mechanism was set up, the mechanism worked, but the vaccines were not available. So to me, this speaks of not only the health community needing to maybe build a better manual of instructions for when the next pandemic hits, with more authority devolved on someone in the system capable of orchestrating the response, but also better coordination between different parts of the international community, which is what we lacked during the vaccine episodes. So a better link up between the WHO, the World Trade Organization, the World Intellectual Property Organization, and the humanitarian side of the UN to really approach the access to medicines from a value chain, with a value chain vision that starts from the innovation and ends in the market. We only did parts of it, and we did this in a disjointed manner. This is what I would offer by way of comment.
We have time for one last question. Person on the far right, my far.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Tom Goodwin. I work at the Department for International Trade, and I wanted to say first, thanks to the LSE for putting this on, because I think it's really important to have this kind of debate and access for people like me in the wider community to come and hear some of these ideas which are shaping the work that we do just down the road. Arantxa, thanks very much for your talk. I would agree with pretty much everything that you said, especially about your miscalculation one about the value of the international order that does exist. I wanted to ask you specifically about the EU, and you've said something about regional organizations, but I think the role of the EU, which obviously has been created in the past 77 years, if you look at the results, on at least in the economic sphere, you'd have to say there are quite a few ticks that the EU can point to. On some of the other challenges that we've been speaking about tonight, not so many ticks. I think, what would you say about the role that the EU could play in building the trust that you've spoken about, developing the norms, promoting the norms that you've spoken about? What's the role of the EU in the new international order? Thank you.
So thank you very much, Tom, because we will end up with one of my favorite topics, which is what's the EU's role in all of this? I didn't want to put it in the speech because this was not about the EU, it was about the international order. But there certainly is, for the EU, and I would say for Europe, beyond the EU, because what we are seeing also is that there is a possibility, you've been following, like I've been following, the birth of the European political community, this new space that in a way gives a view of a geopolitical Europe around the European Union, but with other actors than the European Union, including the United Kingdom. Maybe this is a good way for the United Kingdom and the EU to look into the future and stop filibustering about the past, looking into the future, having as a project to build this more geopolitical Europe with another country called Turkey that we never know if it is in or if it is out, but has decided to come to this European political community first meeting with two countries that have decided don't want to be members of the European Union, but feel very proudly members of Europe, Norway, Switzerland, and with lots of candidate countries that want to become members of the EU, including Ukraine, including Moldova, and hopefully including Georgia. This is Europe, and I think Europe today has a special responsibility, and it's a double responsibility. First is to put its house in order, to take more responsibility, to take more responsibility for its security and its defense. Because if it does, then it can be a more, also more effective stakeholder internationally. So the first task of Europe, not also of the European Union, but also Europe, is to take a greater responsibility for its security and its defense. It's not to build an, just in case people are doubting what I'm saying, it's not to create an alternative to NATO. But if they are in NATO, it's to make sure that NATO also, they take more responsibility within NATO. It's about taking responsibility. But it's also about, and taking more responsibility for the European Union in particular is essentially becoming more strategically autonomous. Having a possibility to decide what it wants to do even when its best friends and allies are not around. And this is what we felt in the past, in the recent past. So it's important that we learn that lesson and we build our capacity to decide for ourselves. But to be a responsible stakeholder also means understanding that we need friends to do that. And a big part of what Europe needs to do and what the EU needs to do is reach out to other countries, work with other countries internationally, not building a fortress in Europe for Europe, for Europeans, reaching out to others, reaching out to Africa, the continent that is closest to Europe and with whom Europe has historic ties beyond description, linking better with Latin America, who are also feeling a bit the same difficulties that the European Union is feeling today. Working with countries in Asia, working with the Pacific, working with the Caribbean. So the role of the EU is responsibility at home and responsibility towards the rest of the world. That's how Europe can help construct and build and infuse a bit more trust in the international system.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure to have the opportunity for both me and I think all of you to have the chance to listen to Dean Gonzalez. Thank you all for taking part. Thank you, Dean Gonzalez.
Thank you. Thank you.